Probation.
State Affairs coming to order at 5:35 p.m. For our Encore Tuesday meeting. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Tuff? Representative Josephson? Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wohl?
Here.
Representative Kopp? Representative Ledoux? Representative Birch?
Here.
Chair of Christ Tompkins?
Here. And with five members present, we have a quorum to do business. We're finishing up with House Bill 44 and HCR 1 per earlier today. I think the goal today is to finish the presentation and exhaust any outstanding committee member questions. A couple of notes. Representative Tuck is not able to make it because of a finance subcommittee conflict, and Representative Ledoux also similarly conflicted. And per the meeting earlier today, the Select Committee on Ethics, through Representative Tuck, has been able to provide some advisory opinions, which are being provided in hard copy, and I think will soon be converted into digital. So that should be on basis and for members and the public's reference. And in addition, we have hard copies of the presentation today from Representative Gren's office, and those are available to the members and presumably will also be available in digital form as well. Representative Gren and Mr. Johnson, would you please feel free to finish your presentation, and we'll take questions from there.
Sure. For the record, Representative Jason Gren, proudly representing District 22 in Anchorage, Alaska.
For the record, Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Jason Gren. So I'm going to continue on with...
Yeah, please, Mr. Johnson.
So continuing on, again, as Representative Gren stated before, we wanted to include some examples of citizen legislatures because Alaska is a citizen legislature. So New Mexico and Wyoming are two examples. Due to the similar size, they are larger in body than Alaska, but similar in size as well as population. And again, just pointing out that New Mexico uses the majority consent of the body to require for an abstention, and they use the general public language when determining a conflict. And then Wyoming, they actually do the majority consent of the Rules Committee required to abstain, and then Wyoming uses the use of the substantial class language. So two examples, and then just two more examples. Again, South Dakota and Idaho, you can see from the slide, South Dakota uses the majority consent of the body, and they use different language than the substantial class or general public. And then Idaho, so Idaho is an example where a state has two separate rules for the Senate and the House. The Senate in Idaho uses a two-thirds consent, and in the House they just abstain by declaring a conflict on the floor, and then they're immediately declared allowed to abstain. So I have also included for you a flowchart which includes the current procedure, and then on the next slide we'll have the procedure under HB 44 and HCR 1. So if you'd like to follow along, I know you have it in hard copy now as well. It's towards the end of your packet. So under the current procedure, a legislator believes they have a conflict of interest under AS 2460-030. The legislator stands on the floor, declares their conflict, and requests to abstain. A unanimous consent is needed to allow for the legislator to abstain. So there is an objection, the legislator abstains and does not, or there is not an objection, and the legislator does abstain and does not vote, which, for note, has never happened in the history of our legislature since the enactment of this rule. And then there is an objection raised, and the legislator is required to vote, and that objection made on the floor is not required or is not recorded in the journal. And Representative Tuck brought up earlier, and a point we would like to make is that there's no record made of the actual conflict from the representative who is declaring a conflict. What's reflected in the journal is X representative stood, declared a conflict. there was an objection, they were required to vote. So that is all that is recorded in the journal as of now. The procedure under or implemented by HB 44 and HGR 1 is noted here. Again, a legislator believes they have a conflict under AS 2460-030. Again, with the amending done in HB 44, it then adds in the employer, immediate family members, and then the immediate family member's employer as well. The legislator stands on the floor, declares a conflict. They explain their conflict and then ask to abstain. Then at that point, a majority consent is required to allow for the abstention. If there is a majority consent, the legislator is allowed to abstain and does not vote. The vote representing the allowing of the abstention is recorded in the journal. And if there is not a majority consent, the legislator must vote, and then that vote is recorded into the journal of that day. And then thank you for your consideration. So we'll take questions at this point.
Representative Ledoux.
So just sort of wondering why it is that a majority must So the majority consents and then the legislator doesn't have to vote or does have to vote?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, if there is a consent, it is allowing the abstention, so the legislator does not vote.
So that would be a majority.
Correct. If there was a majority vote was cast to allow for the abstention, the legislator would not have to vote.
Okay. So is that the way it is done in other legislatures that provide for a majority? Because you could theoretically do it on the flip side of things too. And I was also wondering how it might have been done in the municipal assembly or any assemblies around the state.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, in what we have seen from other states, it's that same kind of method. A legislator must ask to is making a motion to abstain. There is not a majority vote to disqualify them from voting. And then, the municipality, for Anchorage or for Alaska, I do have the statute for that, and it actually goes to a different process where the assembly member asks the presiding officer if they can abstain, and then depending on the decision of the presiding officer, the body can then vote to override that the chair's decision.
So if the presiding officer says yes, it would take yes, you can abstain, then it would take a majority to require that person to vote and vice versa.
Through the chair, Representative, from my understanding, that is correct, but Representative Knopp might be able to answer this question better than or Representative Johnson.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ledoux, that's exactly how it works. What happens in an assembly meeting, assembly member will declare a conflict. The residing officer, president of the assembly, will make that determination if the conflict truly exists. At that point, any member of the body can object to the presiding officer's opinion and ask for a vote of the body to overrule the officer's determination. So if the officer is overruled so hypothetically, if the officer ruled that the member had a conflict, member objected, it would go to a full vote of the body, excluding the member who declared the conflict. And then if the majority voted to override the assembly president, then that member would be required to participate and vote. If they upheld his opinion, then that assembly member would abstain from voting on the issue.
Thank you. And in the spirit of former Representative Grunberg, could I dialogue for a moment with Representative Knopp?
Please, Representative Knopp and Representative Liu, feel free to dialogue.
We've heard Representative Johnson state that in her assembly, it sounds like the system was gamed, depending upon what side of an issue people were on. How'd you feel that it worked out where you were?
You know, in our assembly, local municipal government, there was no partisanship whatsoever. We've never had that as an issue. I did raise that with Representative Gren. I don't know if it would be an issue here or not. I think people would really vote on the validity of the issue. That's how I personally think feel people are ethical enough. They would vote on the issue, not on partisan. So it has never been an issue for us. It's always worked extremely well. I think it's very rarely that we ever had an occasion where members disagreed with the presiding president's opinion on that conflict. So
you've never had an occasion where the presiding member was overruled?
Yes, we have, but it was very rarely.
Oh,
very
okay.
Rarely.
Thank you.
Very rarely.
And we have a wealth of municipal perspectives on this committee, fortunately, Representative Birch, Representative Johnson. I have a question for the sponsor. In one of the slides about halfway through the presentation, I didn't see slide numbers, so I can't cite the exact one. I think it was speaking to how other states grapple with the sort of substantial class definition, that slide. I wanted to ask, that didn't add up to 50 states, so I was wondering what the gap between these 29 states and 50 states, what the other 21 states not included in this breakdown do.
Mr. Chair, yeah, it's you're right. It doesn't add up to 50. The remaining states kind of have a hodgepodge of stealing different language from different states and how they make it their own. We determined that these states in our calculation were very foundational in their language to say they were a substantial class language state, or the effect on general public is the language they used. The others are, I think, a little tougher to determine. If it pleases the committee, we definitely can show the other states or put a breakdown. They might even be actually in our packets. I think we have a breakdown of all 50 states in here of their language, and so you can peruse and see what each state uses. But this calculation was based on what we thought we could tally up and feel very confident in where they landed.
And then the other question I wanted to ask is similar to what Representative Ledoux was asking of Representative Johnson's and Representative Knopf's experience, which is when you spoke with people in other states, I thought I heard you say earlier that no one really referenced or was familiar with this sort of gamesmanship approach to these majority consent votes. And I have to admit, and as you know from the previous committee, I'm actually, really sympathetic to that concern. And I'd want to make sure we're protected against it. And could you maybe speak to which states you spoke with people in as to sort of probing that concern?
Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Gren. Mr. Chair, so in speaking with Wyoming, I bridged that concern to them as of gamesmanship, and they said they had never had received or seen a case like that where someone had used the system in a way to stop someone from voting. I also spoke to someone in New Mexico, because New Mexico is a prime example of a citizen legislature. They receive no salary and only receive $163 a day for this session. So they clearly have people that are working in industries and have conflicts and are employed outside of the legislature. And when talking to there, I spoke to the chief clerk there, and I spoke also to the rules chair, someone in their office, and they said the same thing, that they had never really seen a situation where someone had used this as a mechanism to against another legislator. It was kind of in the spirit of what Representative Knopf was talking about, is that people take this seriously and try and use an objective view when they look at this and make a decision on the facts presented.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my only thought was the way that it's written is two-thirds majority on the vote. Is that correct? Two-thirds?
Just a majority, not a two-thirds majority, just a majority of the body.
Sorry.
The language HB or HCR 1 is a majority vote of the body.
And not to hurry you, just make sure to identify yourself in there, because I suspect your voices sound somewhat similar throughout the tape. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair. So I guess I was just wondering if you know, it might be potential to make it a two-third majority or a three-quarter majority, so you don't, you know, you're not going to end up with a, I mean, you know, it's a little more of a stringent requirement, I guess.
And through the chair, Representative Johnson, obviously there's states that have a two-thirds majority, and through our research, you know, we found what the breakdown is. And even though a majority of them use a majority vote, the main basis of where we came and why we landed on that was to be consistent with what we're asking municipalities to do. Again, ours is a larger body than what municipalities in terms of membership. But, you know, we're here to discuss amendments and off in offices and go through potential changes. And so we're willing to discuss reasons for changes. So we'd be happy to talk.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few points, so please bear with me. On the very last thing you just said about municipalities and trying to be like them, but as Representative Knopp pointed out, at least his municipality is nonpartisan. People don't have D's and R's after their name. They're probably a smaller body. I assume a borough assembly is 7, 9, 11, something like that, not 40. And I'm not that experienced being in this legislature, but there are a lot of votes that are very partisan and party line, and so that suggestion maybe is not a bad one to try to break away beyond just necessarily parties. So a few questions, and I'll start from the beginning where I started notes the other day. So Representative Birch asks, is there any particular case you can think of that this is trying to remedy? In other words, was there something that came up in recent history that you can recall that this bill would try to solve? And as I recall, you didn't really have a particular case, but you said transparency and public trust. Was that kind of it, sort of get the public more confident in our transparency?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, you're correct. This the desire to put forward this legislation was not based on any previous actions, any previous legislation.
Well, I just, if I may, through the chair, I can think of a couple examples in my observation where the public has maybe lost some confidence and trust, and I'm not picking on any one industry or any individuals in any one industry, but I will use the oil industry as an example, where if an individual works in the oil industry and then votes on a certain a bill that affects that industry, there's a lot of people that have some problems with that. But this bill wouldn't address that at all. If I'm an oil exec and a legislator, or executive, if I'm an employee of an oil company and a legislator and I vote on an oil tax bill, this bill will not touch me. Is that correct?
Brian Johnston, staff representative Graham, through the chair, Representative Wool, under the current statute, there is no provision for an employer-employee relationship. It's only about negotiating employment. But with the new legislation, in our opinion, it does open the avenue for a potential employer, because it does include about an employer. But it would just have to fall under that standard if the substantial class language is met. So if Representative Klayman in Judiciary used the example, if he worked as an ARCO, like he represented ARCO, and if there was a oil legislation that came about that specifically affected ARCO benefit or harm more than the rest of the oil industry, then yet we would say that he does have a conflict of interest there and he would need to declare it. So these are very, I know you're not going to like the answer, but it's very fact-driven situations that need to be taken into account. So it's, I would not say no, that this legislation would not do that to any executive at any business not just the oil industry, but it would be, it does open the door now, but under current law, I would say no, it does not.
I'm more interested in your bill, not in current law. So if I'm an oil employee, I work for an oil company, and I work on a bill that affects oil taxes, which is not any particular oil company, but the whole class of oil companies. And I don't declare a conflict of interest, and or I do, but this bill, because I'm just a regular employee voting on a bill that affects an industry, this bill would not affect my voting or not voting.
And maybe just a point, and this sort of coming out of the previous committee, I wonder, even though we're going all over the place with our hypotheticals, if maybe
this is actually something that happens. Yeah, it's not chicken farming. It's bills, oil taxes, and oil employees.
And that's actually the point I'm about to make, which is maybe just sort of maintain a circumspection about how pointed the hypotheticals get.
Yeah, and I don't mean to point out anyone in particular, and so I could use chicken farming, but that's a little obtuse, I guess. But anyhow, and I'm not trying to. You can
Mr.
answer
Johnson,
it or not, and I'll go on.
Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Graham, through the chair to Representative Wool. I think this bill does. There are situations where an executive from any business would have to question, and because it then goes to a vote of the body, that legislator then can stand and make the case for either, hey, I fall under this conflict, but, you know, I think I have an objective view and I can vote my conscience on this, and then it goes, or they can say, hey, I have a substantial conflict, I would like to be excused from this vote, and then it goes to a vote of the body. And so it's really focused on, HDR1 is really focused on putting things on the record from that vote, because then it shows that you requested to abstain, and then either the body, a majority of the body agreed with you and you were allowed to abstain, or they said, you know, your conflict isn't substantial and you can vote. And then from the employer side of it, again, this legislation is adding in an employer, because previous statute does not have that. So this is really focused on, I think, in adding in that situation you're talking about with an employee-employer relationship.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. Well, you said something that I'm not sure you realize, but you said I could stand up and say, hey, I can vote on this, but that's not what this is about. This is standing up to abstain and then having a vote about abstaining. This isn't standing up to say, hey, I work for this company, but I'm still going to vote. That's a totally different issue. If I felt I could vote, I wouldn't stand up to abstain. That's my understanding of it. So there is a discussion. If I say, hey, I have a conflict of interest, I don't want to vote, and then there's a vote on the floor, then there's a dialogue, a discussion, right? There's some sort of disclosure of more detail?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, it's a non-debatable motion. So after, if a legislator was to stand, they made their peace and spoke to their conflict, it would immediately be taken up as a vote. There would be no debate on the motion.
Okay. Follow up? Yeah. Now, you made mention in one of your flowcharts that, as it currently states, I claim a conflict of interest. Someone just blurts out, I object, and then I'm told to vote. What if that was more formal? What if the person stood up, had to be on record and say, I, so-and-so, object to that person abstaining? Would that be better? Would that sort of make this any better? Would that be enough?
You know, we're speaking to what the bill is proposing, and focus on what we believe are beneficial changes. I mean, there's maybe more hypotheticals regarding what might be better, but you know, we're focusing on what we're proposing.
Okay, and my last comment, I guess I'm just trying to figure out, again, back to Representative Birch's question, and I'm not that experienced. I haven't been around here that long, and you guys have probably been around here less, but based on my limited, I'm just what situation are we? Is it really? And I guess there's an example of a case in front of us, so I can read that. I'm just trying to play it out in my mind how it's going to work and if it's going to be overly cumbersome with a lot of So, anyhow, I'm done.
Thanks, Representative Wolt. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not a question, just a brief comment. So I want to reply to Representative Wolt. If an individual stood up and objected, you'd want to give reason why you objected. And so it has probably the same merit as a speaker standing up or saying, I would support your conflict or not. So you probably wouldn't want to get into that debate on the floor with 40 members. You know, everybody would have a different opinion on that. So my comment for Representative Gren, and I appreciate you bringing it forward. The bill's got a lot of support in the public because there are perceived conflicts. But I think for the most part, they are perceived. We historically don't have the issue of conflicts, and I think members are generally good about declaring what they think is a conflict. I think that's always a debatable issue. And so I want you to know that I like the attempt, and I agree with you. I don't like the process we have on the floor about the objection. I'd rather see the chair make the decision and then the body decide to object to his decision or not, you know. If that was what was in front of us, I'd be behind you 100%. But what I can't support, I think, is all the proposed changes in the declaration of conflicts. I think that's my problem when we start getting down into family members and employment. I mean, I think that we are so cautious right now about declaring everything that we just get to be so cumbersome and inefficient on the floor, and that is my big concern. If we'd had a history of really of a lot of potential conflicts and abuse, and I'd be behind it, but that doesn't seem to be the case. So I'm not really sure what we're trying to fix other than the one issue about our process currently on the floor. So I just wanted to make that for the record. Thank you.
Further questions or comments from the committee? Representative Johnson.
I want to commend the bill sponsor for just, I think it's a really honest attempt to, and I mean, you know, maybe more than an attempt to work on something that I think the public really, you know, wants to see or to have some maybe additional reassurance on. And so anyway, I just appreciate you bringing it forward. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
I appreciate your bringing it forward, and I wholeheartedly support it.
And before this sounds like too funereal or as though we're reaching the end of the tunnel, I should note, and I think for members' information as well as the sponsor, we'll hold this probably for a solid week, both to allow the sponsor to have conversations or any of you who are interested in tweaking components of the bill through amendments or whatever it might be, and we'll revisit it at that point in time. So lots of time to sort of sit, contemplate, work it over. And have conversations. So hopefully that allows the process to work well. And on that note, given that I know there are a panoply of receptions tonight in Juneau and personal lives to live and all of that, barring further questions or comments from the committee, adjourn this meeting at 6:03 p.m. and thank everyone for being here.